Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a Democratic pollster tells us how the environment is an issue in the presidential campaign. Life without plants, animals, and kids is bad for your health. Bringing them into nursing homes is changing the environment and the lives of the people who live there. Indigenous people relate to plants in ways we hardly comprehend. They've chewed coca leaves and made plant medicines for centuries. We climb a mountain in Pennsylvania and watch the hawks circling as they begin their journey south. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. During this campaign season, we've been talking periodically to Democratic and Republican pollsters about what role, if any, environmental issues are having in political campaigns and the upcoming election. This week, we hear from Celinda Lake, who is a Democratic pollster. Are you seeing areas or segments of the population where the environmental issue is particularly strong? And are there any surprises for you since you've been following this for so long?
There are a couple of areas where it's strong. It's very strong in upscale suburban districts, and it's very strong in Oregon, Washington, California. And, of course, Oregon and Washington are real battlegrounds at both the presidential level as well as below the presidential level. It's also one of the many issues that matter to the so-called soccer moms, the married women with children in the suburbs who are Republican and they're leading but voting very strongly for Bill Clinton right now. We also find that when we combine the environment with campaign contributions, you voted to relax toxic dumping standards while taking $50,000 from chemical companies, that it matters to blue-collar voters and, one of the surprises, to Perot voters, who are both very anti-big money in politics and also strong conservationists because they tend to be hunters and anglers.
At the presidential level, Celinda Lake thinks the environment is a factor with respect to the generation gap and is helpful to Bill Clinton on the character issue.
The thing that's very, very interesting about the environment at the presidential level is because Bob Dole doesn't mention it very much, it's one of the issues that reinforces the age distinction between these candidates. And I think it's one of the reasons you see Bill Clinton talking about it more. We found that when we raise the environment and ask candidates to talk about it, or voters to talk about the candidates in the presidential context, they said, Bob Dole wouldn't understand this issue. He's too old to understand this issue. He's our grandfather's age. We taught our grandfathers about recycling. The environment is perceived to be a baby boomer issue. It's also, very interestingly, an issue that people think standing up for the environment shows character. And it's one of the places where Bill Clinton can show that he has the right values.
Celinda Lake is a Democratic pollster. Next week, we'll hear from a Republican pollster. The indoor environment is important to everyone. But if you're confined to a nursing home, the indoor environment is your only environment. For many, that means sterile institutional halls, no companionship, and few living things to relate to, either plant or animal. A new philosophy is taking hold across the country that seeks to bring new life into nursing homes and thus enhance the environment and the life of the people who are there. Our civilization has separated us from the plants and animals that once were part of our being. Now we're bringing them back for our own survival. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
The Tioga Nursing Facility in the western New York town of Waverly doesn't fit the mold of an average nursing home. The atmosphere inside is lively. Residents and staff move around amid dogs, bird cages, and cats. Plants are everywhere. 2 years ago, Tioga adopted a plan called the Eden Alternative It calls for treating residents by treating their environment.
Prior to the implementation of Eden, this facility was pretty bare, very sterile, like a normal nursing home. In the period of about 4 months, we brought in 1,000 plants, 350 birds, 6 dogs, 6 cats, and we've recently added 98 kindergartners to our campus. It was extremely radical because we have no more quietness. It is lively. It's chaos sometimes. The kids are chasing the dogs, so we're chasing the cats, so we're trying to eat the birds, and the residents are laughing in the side.
Maria Landy is the assistant administrator at Tioga. She says that by nearly all accounts, the move to the Eden alternative has been a good one. Medically, the results have been impressive. In homes using the Eden alternative, death rates dropped 25% in 2 years. Use of medicine came down 75%, and infection rates were cut in half. The Eden alternative was created by Dr. Bill Thomas, author of the new book, Life Worth Living. He says the concept is simple.
The problems in the nursing home are not really medical problems. They're spiritual problems. People have lost their mooring or their connection to the world around them, and they suffer from loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. What we're trying to do here is to create a complex environment where things happen. People take care. People have moments of companionship. We create a very rich, vibrant environment that supports just the organic development of caregiving and companionship and warm social relations between people.
The residents at Tioga say they're pleased with the program. At first, some were skeptical. Some even shooed the animals out of their rooms, fearing they'd catch fleas. But today, nearly every room has birds and plants. Clarabelle Smith has lived at Tioga for about a year. Her room has about 10 different kinds of plants.
You know what? They're company. They are. And they say if you talk to your plants or have music, they'll grow better. And I believe it because mine do so good. And if you speak to your plants the same way with your pets, you got company.
Clarabelle Smith's room looks out over fields where children from a nearby school play soccer and football. Next to the fields is Tioga's garden, which is tended by both residents and staff. The food is used in the facility's kitchen and for pets.
So millet and sunflower are used and then fed to the birds that accept that kind of food inside the nursing home. And it's, again, a part of the cycle of regeneration and taking care that's so important.
You know, in many ways it seems that what's going on here is really obvious. You know, I mean, it's... The woman inside in the at lunch, you know, called you the genius and that sort of thing.
Yeah, did you say? I was sort of like, well.
But in some ways it is. But then again, in some ways it's so obvious.
It is so obvious. You know, I was delighted to graduate from Harvard Medical School. I got a wonderful training there, but this has nothing at all to do with my medical education. This has to do with responding in a common sense way to the needs of the human beings who live inside a nursing home. These are basic fundamental issues, just as important as your blood sugar or your blood pressure, and we need to attend to them.
A couple of flights above the garden is yet another part of the Eden alternative. Kindergarten teacher Stacy Johnson greets us at the door.
Hi.
We don't want to disturb you. Just want to come in for a minute.
When the local school district was short on space, administrators at Tioga saw a golden opportunity to bring children together with residents.
It connects them with a part of a real life, a life worth living. To have touch with the vibrancy and excitement of the kids is, again, that's something I cannot prescribe. I can't write an order. Feel the excitement of watching kids play. You know, can't do it. It's got to be provided in a real organic sense, a real sense of human community. And that's what we're trying to create with the kids and the older folks.
Although the kindergartners have their own wing, their mere presence is enough to lift spirits. In the lobby, Harold Armrine watches the activity. He says when he came here, he didn't think he'd live through the first year. Now he's one of the most socially active residents at Tioga.
It does help an awful lot to see you through bad times. It sees you through. I know it has me because I love animals. I love flowers and plants. In my apartment, I had some around, you know, hanging baskets and whatever. And they were part of my life.
Armrine seems to thrive amid the disorder. He greets people as they walk by and keeps a close eye on the home's birds. Dr. Thomas says this is just how the program should work.
Every time we turn around, we're seeing a cat or we're seeing a bird or there's plants along the hallways here. If we look out the window, you can see the kids from the kindergarten having recess. And there's a real sense that life is everywhere you turn. We don't want to sprinkle little bits of life on people. We want to submerge them in it. We want to surround them with it. We want to create a world where they where they turn is some part of life, a life worth living.
Before I left Tioga, Harold Armrine made sure to show me his birds and plants and the view from his room of the playground. He says there was much more to see and do, but I was worn out and ready to head home. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
American researchers are introducing plants to nursing homes to humanize them. The whole process seems pretty primitive in comparison with the deep relationship indigenous peoples in Latin America have had with plants for centuries. Wade Davis is an ethnobotanist and anthropologist. An ethnobotanist is someone who studies the interaction between human societies and plants. Davis has just written a book called One River, in which he tells the story of his research and the adventures of two plant explorers in the Amazon, Tim Plowman and Richard Schultes. He says it's impossible to understand a culture in the rainforest unless you know and understand the plants that play a vital role in the lives of the people who live there. Plants have special meaning because of the way they're used. Davis describes medicinal plants, sometimes called drug plants.
It's important to understand that for indigenous peoples, disease concepts are very different than ours. And for most indigenous peoples of the Amazon, certainly, and many indigenous peoples from around the world, disease is not defined by the simple absence or presence of pathogens, but it's defined as a certain state of sacred equilibrium or disequilibrium in the terms of disease. And treatment, therefore, occurs on two very different levels. On the one hand, there are a series of ailments that are treated symptomatically, much as we would in a rather mundane way, only instead of using medicinal products, they use pharmacologically active plants. But real healing in the mind of these shaman occurs at a level of consciousness, and the real act of medical intervention, it occurs when the shaman invokes some technique of ecstasy to soar away on the wings of trance, to get into the distant metaphysical worlds where he can work or she can work their deeds of medical rescue. And these plants, which are dismissed as quote-unquote drug plants so cavalierly by the West so often, in fact, are never seen as drugs by these societies. They're seen as sacred medicines. Ayahuasca, the famous vision vine of the Amazon, for example, is always called el remedio in Spanish, the medicine, the medicine of all medicines, because ultimately the use of these plants is not only done in a societally positive way. The plants themselves show no evidence of toxicity, certainly no evidence of addictive potential, and rather they're used not as a form of to reinforce alienation in the culture, but to reinforce social solidarity in the group itself.
Davis also says that research on coca plants done by his colleague Timothy Plowman and financed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture gave a whole different perspective on the plant and its importance to people who chew its leaves.
The use of these leaves is the most profound expression of social and cultural and certainly spiritual life in the Andes. You know, in the high Andes, you don't shake hands with someone, you trade leaves. Distances are measured not in terms of miles, but in terms of coca chews. There are entire societies where the societal ideal is to abstain from sex, eating, and sleeping, and do nothing but chew the sacred leaves and chant to the ancestors. And when Tim finally did the first nutritional study of the plant in 1974, he found to his astonishment that coca turned out to be one of the most nutritious plants ever examined by the USDA. It was particularly high in vitamins. It had more calcium in it than any other plant that had ever been studied, which made it perfect for a diet that traditionally lacked a milk product, especially for lactating women. It also had enzymes in it which enhanced the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation, which made it perfect for the Andean potato diet. So suddenly we showed that this plant, which had been completely castigated as a kind of a demon plant, source of cocaine and all that, turned out to be a very mild stimulant, which had been used without any evidence of toxicity for at least 4,000 years by people living in a very harsh environment, not only as a mild stimulant and as a sacred plant, but also as a vital part of their nutrient regime. And that put into perspective the kind of draconian efforts to eradicate the fields campaign that has been propagated by both the Latin American central governments and also by, of course, the U.S. government in the war on drugs.
Davis found that indigenous peoples have used plants in combination for medicinal purposes which, if taken individually, are indigestible or toxic. Given the number of variables, he finds it impossible to believe that native peoples discovered the combinations by trial and error.
Now, you ask the native people how they made their discoveries, and they always say, well, the plants sung to me. In fact, certain Indians, like the Siona Sequoia of the upper Putumayo and the adjacent areas of Ecuador and southern Colombia, have as many as 17 kinds of ayahuasca, all of which, to our eye as modern taxonomists, are identical. And yet they consistently identify them from some distance in the forest. And you ask them how they form their system of classification, and they say, well, you take the plant on the night of a full moon, and each species sings to you in a different key.
What this probably means, says Davis, is sensitivity to the resonance of nature led to a mysterious zone of mental awareness. This, in turn, led to the discovery of these plant combinations. It seems that humans of many cultures have used the plants around them to improve their health and enrich their lives. Davis shows that when it comes to understanding this process, those of us living in the developed Western world are probably the most primitive and ignorant of all. I'm Peter Burley. As summer begins to fade, all kinds of birds begin their annual trek south. In the northeastern United States, raptors are migrating along the ancient ridges of the Appalachians. Scott Wiedensahl is the author of Raptors, The Birds of Prey. Each year at this time of year, you can find him banding hawks and other birds high atop a mountain in Pennsylvania. He presents a portrait of that mountain, and later we'll talk to him in our Earth calendar about the migration.
There's a piece of sandstone I keep on my desk, gray as a foggy morning and lumpy with chunks of white quartzite. The rock's a physical reminder of my favorite natural place, a boulder-strewn mountaintop in the Pennsylvania Appalachians where I watch and catch and band hawks each autumn. It's a long, hard climb to the top, through forests of oak and tulip trees, but once you're there you can look north over the ridges and valleys to the hazy, distant Poconos, across a sky dotted with migrant hawks. The raptors come by the tens of thousands each year, funneled down the Appalachians by wind and geography, and we stretch our nets to catch them. And no matter how many hundreds of times I do it, I'm never prepared for the almost electric experience of holding a wild hawk in my hands. I remember one in particular from last season, a female Cooper's hawk, a blue-gray hunter the size of a crow that we lured into our mist nets. She was furious, not frightened as far as I could tell, just angry. I held her gently high on the legs so I could keep her long, sharp talons well away from me. It was a cold day in mid-October, and beneath the feathers, the hawk's body was hot, and I could feel, very faintly, the rhythmic bump of her heart. She glared at me, the feathers of her head flared out like a warrior's bonnet, and her red eyes were shining with indignation. Around her right leg, I attached a lightweight government band, stamped with a series of numbers and a brief address. After taking her weight and a dozen or so measurements, I let the hawk go. If anyone finds her again, maybe hit by a car or stunned after colliding with a window, and if they report the band number to the government, we'll learn a little bit more about where hawks go and how they live. It's long odds that any one hawk will ever be found or caught again, of course. The usual recovery rate, as it's known, is only 2 or 3%. So we play a numbers game, banding as many hawks as we can, hoping that a few will turn up again someday in the future and fill in a little chink in our knowledge of birds. So that's the science. But science doesn't provide the astonishing sense of chained lightning that comes when a red tail hurtles down on us, wings folded, legs outstretched, tearing the sky apart with its dive. And it isn't science that makes my hand tremble when I release that hawk again to the northwest wind. The very first hawk I banded, a beautiful adult red tail with eyes the color of chocolate, was also my first recovery. I banded it with nervous fingers, stroked its brick orange tail, and returned it to the sky with a silent prayer. Maybe I should have prayed harder. 3 months later, in central North Carolina, someone found the same hawk, broken and battered along a highway. It was still alive when they found it, but it died a short time later at a wildlife rescue center. Where are the others I've banded through the years, I wonder? How many have died anonymous deaths, but how many are still flying, stitching the continents together with their travels? Every year, from Labor Day until the first snowfall, we sit in our cramped blind, looking out over the gentle, sway-backed mountains beneath a sky alive with birds. Sometimes science bounds ahead in great leaps, but more often the progress is slow, a long series of tiny steps. One more hawk, one more band, one more day on a chilly mountaintop, watching the autumn flow by like a river.
Joining us now for the Earth Calendar is Scott Wiedensahl, author of Raptors, the Birds of Prey. Broad-winged hawks are in the peak of their migration through Pennsylvania this week. He tells us what we'd see if we look into the sky above Hawk Mountain now.
Well, if you picked a day when there was a nice northwest wind blowing, you might see a nice selection of hawks. This is the beginning of the fall migration. Things are really starting to roll along now in mid-September. You'll see a fair number of ospreys and also bald eagles, mostly bald eagles from Florida, that are heading back south basically after a summer vacation. And you'll also see a lot of broad-winged hawks. The broadwings are the real main actors in the fall hawk migration in September, and they move in tremendous numbers. It's not unusual to see groups of 200 or 300 or 400 of them flying in flocks called kettles at this time of the year.
Now, have their migration routes and patterns changed over the years?
Well, that's one of the things that hawk watchers love to speculate about, especially on those slow days when the hawks have pretty much vanished out of the sky. Here in the Appalachians, there's a fair bit of speculation that broad-winged hawks have shifted their migration patterns somewhat. Back in the 30s and 40s up through the 1970s, the broadwings seemed to be following the ridgetops for the most part. But ridge counts have gone down quite a bit in recent years, and it doesn't seem to be because the population of broad-winged hawks have gone down. One of the favorite bits of speculation is that suburban parking lots down in the more heavily urbanized valleys are actually luring the broad-winged hawks off the ridges. I mean, if you've got 40 or 50 acres of asphalt in a giant mall parking lot, that's going to produce an awfully good column of rising hot air. And it may just be that the broad-winged hawks are hopping from parking lot to parking lot down through the megalopolis here on the East Coast.
The population of broadwings seem to be maintaining itself, but there is concern as the forests are becoming fragmented in northern South America, where the birds winter, and in the northeast in Canada, where they nest. If indeed the broadwings are changing their migration routes to take advantage of rising hot air generated by parking lots, I propose that we postpone national political conventions in the future to mid-September. Think of how all the hot air that's generated could help raptors on their journey south. If we located the conventions in the right places, we could hawk candidates and help hawks migrate all at once. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 350. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.